Well, turn with me again, please, to Genesis chapter 3. We looked last week at the first 13 verses of this passage, and we're going to look this morning then at verses 14 and 15. Now, if you type into an internet search engine the words, "What would God say to?" you will find that plenty of results come up, whether it's what would God say to Richard Dawkins, or what would God say to Britney Spears, or what would God say to America, or what would God say to Rowan Williams, or whatever it might be. Some of these are serious articles, evangelistically driven attempts to connect with modern people. Others are blatantly satirical pieces poking fun at Christianity and at the Bible. But whatever the different motives involved, this is clearly a frequently asked question. And I want to ask the question this morning, and I want to ask it in this particular form: what would God say to the devil? What would God say to the devil? And happily, I can be much less speculative and hypothetical than most of these people writing on the internet, because while we don't have any record anywhere of anything God has ever said to Britney Spears, we do have a record in the Bible of several things that God has said to the devil. And I suppose that the most significant instance of that, the most significant instance of God addressing the devil, is here in Genesis chapter 3. Now, some of you might be thinking, but hang on a minute, the devil is never even mentioned here. This isn't God addressing the devil, this is simply God addressing a serpent. Well, I hope that if you are thinking that, you're not somebody who was here last week, because last week we explained that here in this passage, there is clearly more to this serpent than meets the eye. No ordinary serpent acts the way in which this serpent acts. No ordinary serpent manifests the kind of agenda that this serpent manifests. Even to Moses' first readers, those Israelites, those children of Israel there in the wilderness, living as they were so long before the book of Revelation would eventually make an explicit link between the serpent and the devil, and living indeed so long before the devil and Satan were even part of the vocabulary of the people of God, even to them, it must have been pretty obvious that this was no common or garden snake, that they were being introduced here to a highly sinister and implacable enemy of the Most High God. Now, I admit that things are complicated slightly by those words, "Cursed are you above all the livestock and all the wild animals." Words which seem much more applicable, don't they, to the serpent considered merely as an ordinary reptile than to the serpent considered as the devil. But we'll touch upon that later on in our service. And suffice to say for just now that our basic approach, I think, to this passage should be this: that this is God speaking face to face to none other than the devil himself. And I want to notice then three things that emerge from this. First of all, a conquest. A conquest. Because God begins then, doesn't he, in verse 14, "Because you have done this." And we need to ask the question then, to what is God here referring? What is it that the serpent has done? Well, the answer is, of course, that the serpent has just achieved a great conquest by his clever temptations via Eve. He has caused Adam to violate the one and only prohibition which God had laid upon him in the Garden of Eden. And by so doing, then, he has rendered Adam disobedient before God. And as disobedient before God, he has rendered Adam therefore liable to the penalty which God had attached to the prohibition, he has rendered him liable to death itself. But of course, it's much more than that, isn't it? That's only the start of it. Because of Adam's unique role as the representative of the entire human race, in a single stroke, the serpent has not only rendered Adam guilty of disobedience and Adam liable to death, but he has rendered the entire human race that is yet to be born, he has rendered all of them guilty of disobedience and liable to the penalty of death. Now we perhaps ought to say a word about that for a moment. I half intended to do this last week, but we were a bit pushed for time. But you might be thinking that there's something odd here. Because back in chapter 2, verse 17, God had been quite clear, hadn't he? That when you eat of it, when you eat of the forbidden fruit, you will surely die. It's even clearer in the Hebrew, in the day that you will eat of it, you will surely die. And yet, here now in chapter 3, Adam has eaten of it. He has eaten the fruit, and yet he hasn't died. And he's not going to die before the sun goes down on this day. Indeed, he's not going to die until he reaches the grand old age of 930. So why then is the penalty delayed for the best part of a millennium? Why, when God had originally threatened it in such explicit terms that it's going to be on the day that you eat of it that you'll die, why does it take 930 years for it actually to happen? Well, I think the answer is that the biblical concept of death is much more nuanced than we often take into account. I think that within the biblical concept of death, we can identify at least three stages. First of all, there is a death this side of the grave. That's clear, isn't it, from what Paul writes, for instance, in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 5, where he says that because God is rich in mercy, he made us alive with Christ when we were dead. And I think that in that specific sense then, Adam did die when he ate the fruit back in verse 6. What do I mean by that? Well, look at what Adam is doing in verse 8. We referred to it in our prayer earlier on. What's he doing there? He's hiding from God among the trees of the garden. Now, if it really is the case that man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever, if, in other words, it really is the case that this is the purpose of life, this is the reason we live, this is why we are alive, in order to glorify and enjoy God, and I think that is the case, then at this moment, when Adam is hiding away from God, behind trees, paralyzed by guilty fear, every impulse to glorify and enjoy God utterly gone, is it not the case that in a very real sense he's dead? Certainly according to the true definition of what life is, he's no longer living. He might be breathing, his blood might be circulating, he's living at a physical level. But according to the true definition of what life really is, Adam is dead. So there's life, there's death this side of the grave. But then again, there's the grave itself, secondly. There is the actual shutting down of our bodies. There is physical death. There is our dust returning to dust. But then, thirdly, there is a death beyond the grave. The unending and unrelieved torment and misery of hell itself. And that, of course, is the fullest and most complete form of death. That is death in its ultimate sense, in its ultimate expression. And that surely is the serpent's crowning achievement. That is his supreme achievement here in the Garden of Eden then. Not simply that he had condemned human beings, to that death which we experience from the moment we're born, that perpetual hiding away from God all our lives. Not merely that, although that must have pleased him. And not merely the fact that he had condemned human beings to physical death, to our bodies one day ending up inanimate corpses to be buried 6 feet under the ground. Although that too must have pleased the serpent. But surely his supreme achievement here was the fact that he had condemned human beings to death in its ultimate expression, to nothing less than everlasting hell. And he had won the right, you see, from this moment on, to irresistibly demand that every single human being die that everlasting death. He had won the right to now go to God and demand that this person and that person and the next person and every person die in that fullest sense. He could now go to God and say, look, God, there's this man here. And because of his connection with Adam and what happened in the Garden of Eden, he must die. And look, God, there's this woman here. And because of her connection with Adam and what happened in the Garden of Eden, she must die. She must suffer everlasting torment. And he could reel off the names of every single member of the human race and insist in every single case, death, 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 each of them, all of them, have to die. That surely is his supreme achievement here in the Garden of Eden. And it's no understatement then, this first heading. This is a conquest. To see the ruin that he has brought upon God's wonderful creation. He has effectively killed the highest and sublimest component of the whole creation. He's killed the human race. He has dealt this terrible blow to his enemy, God. He has achieved a conquest of really, really massive proportions. So that's the first thing then, a conquest. But secondly, notice a reversal. A reversal. Because in the light of this conquest then, which the serpent has just achieved, you would have expected, wouldn't you, that God would appear a rather sad and forlorn figure in this passage. You would have expected self-pity, or at best, grim resignation, to be the dominant note in his speech here. But it's not like that, is it, when you read this speech? You just don't get that feel, do you, when you read what God has to say here? There's a certain steel, isn't there? There's a certain self-assurance about the tone of God's voice here. You might even say that he's in combative mode as he addresses the serpent here. There's nothing of that self-pity, nothing of that grim resignation that you might have expected, but there's an aggressiveness, there's a combative tone to the way in which he confronts the serpent. This comes across very clearly, I suppose, when you contrast the way in which he speaks to the serpent here with the way in which he has just spoken to Adam and Eve. With Adam and Eve, he has been interrogative, hasn't he? He has asked them questions. To Adam, where are you? Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree from which I commanded you not to eat? And then to Eve, what is this you have done? He asks them questions. He gives them the opportunity to defend themselves and to explain their actions. But now as he moves to the serpent, there's a marked contrast, isn't there? He's no longer interrogative. He's declarative now. He's simply saying, you will, I will, he will. No opportunity for the serpent to defend himself. No opportunity for the serpent to explain his actions. It's simply God saying, this is what is going to happen. It is then, as I say, a combative kind of speech that God delivers here. And in verse 15 then, he comes out with these well-known words, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel. And perhaps the best way of of understanding what God is saying here to the serpent is by a kind of extended paraphrase of it. God is effectively saying something like this. He's saying, look, serpent, you may appear to have just achieved a great conquest. You may appear to have irremediably killed the human race. You may appear to have brought death cascading down upon every single one of them. But look, serpent, the human race isn't going to just lie down and die. The human race is going to fight back. It's going to start with Eve. And all right, this woman, she may have complied meekly with your wishes on this day. On this day, she may have been allured by your charms. But from now on, she is going to be against you. She is going to be at enmity with you. She is going to be antagonistic toward you. From now on, she is going to devote her life to defying your demands and to resisting your ways and to frustrating your purposes and to fleeing your temptations. From now on, she is going to devote her life to me and to my glory. She is going to be the kind of woman who upon the birth of her firstborn son will cry out with the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man, chapter 4, verse 1. But that's not all, serpent. Eve is only going to be the beginning of it. Eve is only going to be the start of it all. Now, I concede, serpent, that you will always have your people within the human race. You will always have those who belong to you. So the human race in its entirety isn't going to fight back against you. There will always be some. There will always be those of whom it may be said they are your offspring. They are the serpent's offspring. Those of whom it may be said you belong to your father, the devil, John chapter 8, verse 44. There will always be those people in amongst the human race. I concede that. But there will always be Eve's offspring too. There will be generation after generation after generation after generation of men and women just like Eve. And they will devote their lives to me and my glory. And they will devote their lives to opposing and standing against and praying against your offspring, your people within this world. And that's not all, serpent. It's going to be even better than that. There's something even more than that I need to tell you. And it's this, that not only is there going to be a fight back, not only is there going to be this stream of people within the human race constantly opposing and resisting you and your offspring in this world, but ultimately, it is going to win. Ultimately, it is going to have the victory. Ultimately, it is going to defeat you. It is going to crush your head. It's going to defeat you that totally, that extensively, that devastatingly. In other words, I'm saying to you, serpent, that this conquest that you have achieved today in the Garden of Eden, it's going to be turned on its head. It's going to be reversed. And one day, it's going to appear the most hollow conquest. It's going to appear the most forgettable conquest on that day when your skull finally lies smashed into smithereens. It's something like that, I think, that God is saying here to the serpent. And you see then what a wonderful thing that is. We're just 9 verses on from Adam eating the fruit of that tree. And yet here already you see God is bringing hope into this hopeless situation. Here already God is beginning to wipe the smile off the serpent's face. Here already God is beginning to announce the most monumental, the most breathtaking reversal of the terrible conquest that has just taken place. So we've seen a conquest, firstly. Secondly, we've seen a reversal. But thirdly and finally, notice an explanation. An explanation. Because we need to ask the question then, don't we? How is this reversal that God is intimating here, how is it going to take place? Now, there's a certain ambiguity in this second half of verse 15 as to the precise identity of the skull crusher, of the one who is going to destroy the serpent. You see, it could be referring to the offspring of the woman in a general sense. In other words, it could be saying that all those generations of men and women that I've just mentioned, all those generations of men and women who are going to be like Eve and are going to stand against and oppose the cause of the serpent and are going to live for the glory of God. It could be saying that in each case, in every single generation, all those men and women are going to triumph over their enemies who are aligned with the serpent. And to a certain extent, I think it is saying that. Because at the end of the day, is that not borne out as you read the remainder of the Old Testament? For what is the story of Jacob and Esau? What is the story of Moses and Pharaoh? What is the story of David and Goliath? What is the story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal? What is the story of Mordecai and Haman, if not the story of the offspring of the woman, Eve's God-honoring line, defeating the offspring of the serpent? But I don't think that the meaning of this passage, the meaning of this verse, is exhausted by that. I don't think it's just referring to the offspring of the woman in a general sense. I think it's also, and indeed more importantly, referring to the offspring of the woman in a particular sense. In other words, it's referring to one specific person, which is why then the translation that we have here and in most of our English versions is highly appropriate. Not it will crush your head or they will crush your head, but he, one specific person, is going to crush your head. And God is promising then that for all the achievements of Jacob and Moses and David and Elijah and Mordecai, there is going to be one person who is going to emerge from that same line who will out-achieve all of them, and who in a more definitive and a more final and a more decisive and in a more irreversible sense than they will crush not only the serpent's offspring, but even the very serpent himself. And as you read through the Bible then, and I scarcely need to spell this out to you, do I? As you read through the Bible, there is only one person, isn't there, who fits that profile. And that person is, of course, the Lord Jesus Christ. One who was unquestionably a descendant of Eve, as much a human being as anyone who has ever walked this planet, and one who, from the very moment that he stepped on the public scene, was engaged in an almost daily struggle, was he not, with the devil himself, whether in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, or whether in the numerous personal exorcisms that he carried out, or whether even through the words of his own closest companion, Peter, to whom he had to say, "Get behind me, Satan." Jesus Christ, I'm saying, is beyond a shadow of a doubt the skull crusher that is being promised in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. But that still doesn't actually answer the question that I've asked, does it? Because the question I asked was, how is this going to take place? How is this reversal going to happen? Well, we need to consider, don't we, that final clause in verse 15. He will crush your head and you will strike, but it's the same Hebrew word again, we don't need to translate it any differently, and you will crush his heel. And we need to ask, don't we, why is that clause there?
Why is that clause included here? Because on the face of things, it seems, doesn't it, as though God is here offering the serpent a bit of consolation. You know how in a game of football, if one team is winning 6-0 or something, and then in the last few minutes the other team gets a goal back, then people say, well, it was good, they at least scored a consolation goal. Well, it looks, doesn't it, here, as though God is saying, well, look, serpent, you're going to be defeated, but there is a bit of consolation. Your conqueror, your defeater, he won't escape unharmed. It won't be painless. He too is going to be hurt. But that's a bit odd, isn't it? Because why would God do that? Why in this context of all contexts would God be concerned to offer comfort and reassurance and consolation to the serpent? Well, I think the answer is that that's not what is happening at all here. He is not offering consolation to the serpent. I think that in every detail here, God is in fact twisting the knife. In every detail here, God is in fact maximizing the serpent's distress and the serpent's pain. And not least, I think, is he doing that in this particular detail here. Because you see, God knows that the serpent will understand something here in this phrase. He knows that the serpent will pick up something from these enigmatic terms. He knows that this phrase here, these words here, will send one specific word flashing through the serpent's mind. One specific word which will utterly deflate him and which will spell out to him beyond any doubt that his game is up. And that word is the word substitution. Because you see, the serpent knows that there's only one way in which human beings can possibly escape the penalty which they deserve because of what has just happened in the Garden of Eden. That there is only one way that human beings can possibly become invulnerable to his relentless demands that they die. Only one way that that can happen. And it's by a substitute dying in their place. It's by a substitute taking that death which they deserve because of what's happened in the Garden of Eden in their place. So that then, you see, death can no longer be due to them because it's being taken by somebody else. And then, therefore, the serpent can no longer insist that they die. Because God can respond to the serpent, no, this man here doesn't have to die. This woman here doesn't have to die. A substitute has died in his or her place. And you see, what God is doing here is he's promising that exactly that is going to happen. Yes, in obscure terms, in shadowy terms, in typically Old Testament terms, he's doing it. But that's what he's doing. God is promising that a substitute is going to come. He's promising that this particular conqueror is going to suffer. He's going to have his heel crushed. He's going to die. But by dying, you see, he is going to destroy the serpent, because by dying he will deprive the serpent of the right to condemn millions and billions of guilty sinners for whom he has died. And of course that is exactly what did happen, isn't it? This prophecy, this promise became true. It was realized many centuries later, when on a cross outside of Jerusalem, Jesus Christ, the skull crusher, did indeed crush the serpent's skull in precisely this way, by dying in the place of his people, and by therefore disarming the serpent of his one weapon, by depriving him of the right to ever condemn to death those for whom he had died. And this is why then this passage, written so many centuries ago, and as I say, in some ways so obscure in its language, this is why this passage is of the utmost relevance to you and to me in 2008. It couldn't be more relevant. Because you see, the fact is that by nature, in the condition in which we are born, Satan, this real person, this real being, whether you want to call him Satan or the serpent or the devil or whatever, this real person, he has the right to demand from God that you be punished everlastingly for your sin. He has the right to do that. And make no mistake, he will use that right. And he will insist upon it. And he will ensure that you go down with him to the punishment that God has ordained for guilty sinners. He will ensure that. He will make sure that you don't escape, that you go down with him. But Genesis 3:15 is saying that it needn't happen. Because it's saying there's a conqueror, there's a hero, there's a champion, there's a savior, there's a deliverer, there's a rescuer. There is one who has crushed the serpent's head. There is one who has disarmed him. There is one who has outwitted him. And if you go to him, if you lean upon him, if you make sure he is your conqueror, your savior, your deliverer, your substitute who died in your place, then Satan will from now on be utterly toothless and impotent in relation to you. He will not be able to condemn you to eternal death. You need Jesus Christ, the conqueror promised in Genesis 3:15. Well, we've seen then a conquest, a reversal, and an explanation. I just want to make two concluding points very briefly. First of all, just to touch on verse 14 that I brought up at the start. Why is it there? Why this curse here to the serpent, seemingly as a serpent, as a reptile? Not to the serpent as the devil particularly, but to the serpent as a reptile. Cursed are you above all the livestock and all the wild animals. You will crawl on your belly and you will eat dust all the days of your life. Well, I wonder if we have something similar here to what happens again a little later on in the book of Genesis. You know how in a few chapters' time we're going to have the story of Noah? And you know how there are many similar elements, aren't there, to what we have here in Genesis 3, there again you have a story of human disobedience. There again you have a story of God's judgment, God's punishment, in that case in the form of a deluge, a flood. And there again you have God's grace triumphing in that scene, don't you? You have God making a promise that I will never again do what I have just done. I will never again flood the world in this way. But you remember how there's something else there as well, wasn't there? Something that accompanied the promise. There was the sign, there was the rainbow in the sky. And that was a wonderful provision, wasn't it? For Noah in the first instance and his family, and then for human beings after. But particularly, I guess, for Noah and his family. Can you imagine then? They've come out of the ark because the water has gone, it's subsided. They've come out of the ark. They're getting back to normal life. Can you imagine them the next time it rained? Can you imagine the next time they saw a dark cloud in the sky? The next time they felt raindrops falling on their head? Can you imagine what their instinctive feeling would have been? Terror. Is it going to happen again? Are we going to have another deluge? Are we going to have another flood? Is this God again breaking out in judgment upon the world? But you see, the point of the rainbow was so that they could look up and they could see in that very visible and that very tangible sense, no, God has made a promise. It's not going to happen again. Now, go back to Adam and Eve. And can you imagine them as they get on with their lives after Genesis chapter 3, outside of the Garden of Eden? Can you imagine the next time they saw a serpent in the undergrowth? Imagine the next time they saw a serpent come in near them. Again, there'd have been terror, wouldn't there? Is he again coming to tempt us? Is he again coming to frustrate God's purposes? Is he again coming to ensnare us and to capture us and to wreak havoc like he did last time? But then you see, they'd have been able to look at the serpent and look at its very physical form and its very body language, its very posture. What's it doing? It's sliding along, its belly in the dust, licking the dust, eating the dust. And they'd have been reminded, hang on, God has made a promise. The devil's going to be destroyed. He's going to be defeated. He hasn't the power to overturn God's purposes. He is a defeated foe. What a comfort that would have been to them, just seeing that beast, seeing that reptile, its very appearance would have reminded them, even as the rainbow would have reminded Noah, God has made a promise. And I think there's application to us as well. How do we picture the devil? There's all kinds of caricatures, aren't there? All kinds of cartoon images. I haven't done it, but I should imagine that if you went on Clipart or something and typed in the devil, you'd be able to find all kinds of pictures that are trying to represent this being that I suppose so many would consider mythical anyway. So many different images out there. Well, how do we picture the devil? Well, is this not how we should picture him? As a serpent? Should this not be the primary, dominant image in our minds when we think of the devil? A serpent. Why? Because again, the same reason. It reminds us. The very posture, the very appearance of this creature reminds us that he is a defeated foe. Now, we must never, of course, underestimate the devil. He's still around, and he can still cause great damage. But by seeing him as a serpent, as a beast that slides around on its belly in such a humiliating way, it reminds us he's a defeated foe. Jesus Christ has gained the victory at the cross of Calvary. One other thing then as we close. It's very interesting, isn't it? This is the first gospel promise, isn't it? We often call it that. The first promise of the gospel here in Genesis 3:15. Yet there's something very strange about it, isn't there? And it's this, that it's not actually addressed to us, is it? It's not addressed to Adam and Eve. It's not addressed to human beings at all. God is talking here to the devil. He's conversing with the devil, and it's in that context that the first intimation of redemption emerges. And I think that's significant. I asked just now, how do we think of the devil? Well, how do we think of redemption? How do we think of this great theme that is so precious to us and so important to us as Christians? How do we think of it? Often, perhaps, we think of it simply, don't we, as the meeting of our needs. God meeting our needs as guilty people, and God, in great grace and mercy and love, helping us and stooping down to our aid. Now, that, of course, isn't wrong. That's not unbiblical. That is a very valid way of thinking of redemption. But is this not reminding us that the primary way in which we should think of redemption is not God meeting our needs, but in actual fact, God destroying his enemy? The very first place that redemption emerges as a biblical theme is in that setting. God threatening, God challenging, God condemning his enemy. And I suppose for one thing, if we get that right, it will keep our whole theology in its proper perspective and proportion, won't it? It will remind us that ultimately everything revolves around God. The universe, all things revolve around God. It's God that matters ultimately. All things are from him and through him and to him. It's to him that the glory is owed. And getting this right, that redemption is primarily his means of destroying his enemy, will keep that in view. God is at the center of everything. Everything revolves around him, not around us. But then for another thing, in a kind of ironic way, I suppose, does it not also actually make our redemption seem even more secure? That behind our redemption is not simply God's infinite love for us, although that is there, but behind our redemption is also God's infinite anger at his great enemy, the devil. And behind our redemption is also God's infinite desire to vindicate his own reputation, to vindicate his own glory, and to gain the victory over his enemy. And I'm saying then, with all of those different factors, not just his infinite love, but with all these other factors as well behind our redemption, doesn't it bring home to us? This is an unshakable thing. No one's going to overturn this. No one's going to derail this. Redemption isn't going to lose its momentum. It's not going to peter out. It's not going to hit the rocks. This is for real. This works. God is definitely going to redeem. Amen.